Fodor.
And I'm Chip Hasenflav.
And I'm Pam Bedard.
We're back again with another chapter of A Study in Scarlet, the first of the Sherlock Holmes novels from 1887. This is kind of a concluding chapter, sort of, right?
It's all solved. Everything has been solved.
Problem
solved. Holmes knew it all along.
Chapter 7, Light in the Darkness. We open here with the end of the conversation from Chapter 6, where Lestrade is telling them all about the second murder, which has left them kind of shocked, right?
The intelligence with which Lestrade greeted us was so momentous and so unexpected that we were all three fairly dumbfounded. Gregson sprang out of his chair and upset the remainder of his whiskey and water. I stared in silence at Sherlock Holmes, whose lips were compressed and his brows drawn down over his eyes. And so I kind of love this because even Sherlock didn't see this coming, right? The murder of the secretary. And then Gregson, of course, a little bit clumsy there, jumps up, knocks over his whiskey. And I think it's really interesting that Watson doesn't have his own reaction. Did you guys notice that?
I did. That is very interesting. He is definitely the narrator. He is definitely a part of the conversation, but he does not react.
Steve, how do you feel about the dumping of a whiskey and water?
I was upset by that more than anything. That is for sure. That's a party foul for sure.
So Watson, he's sitting in the room. He's totally a part of the situation. He's about to get into a fight with everybody else, but he is watching Holmes. And so he's our representative in this scene, right? In that he is presumably surprised in his mind, but he doesn't show it. He just records on our behalf.
And that's the first novel, the first story. Mm-hmm. This is Watson identifying who this Sherlock Holmes character is. And that is the centerpiece of the story.
Right. Exactly. And so then Lestrade tells us his whole story of having gone to find the secretary. And I thought there were some really interesting details here. First of all, he absolutely admits that he was mistaken.
Well, that's the first. The first way of coming clean is admitting mm-hmm. you were wrong.
Exactly. And then when he went to, when he goes to the secretary's hotel, he gets some help from the Boots in finding the murdered secretary. Did you guys pause on that? I thought that was very cute.
Yeah, I did. I thought about the Boots. Can you go into that? What is that? The Boots.
Well, I actually was reading it to my kids and they were like, what is this? And I said, oh, I don't know. I presume it's someone who works at the hotel. And my daughter looked it up. It's a boot boy who's a low-level servant at a hotel.
Okay.
I was glad that my kids cared enough to actually look it up. And I was like, oh, the Boots. And so we did learn here that Lestrade does have 20 years of experience on the force. Remember earlier on, we were wondering how old he is. So he is in his 40s, I would think.
Mm-hmm. I would say so. So he is our more seasoned police officer, where Gregson, yeah, it seems like much younger.
And then at the end of his narrative of having found this murdered man, and, you know, as usual, it's described as like one of the most horrific scenes. The Boots almost fainted.
It looks like Watson could write for the Weather Channel. I mean, it's always the worst. It's right. The worst rainstorm ever.
So, exactly. Yeah,
the worst murder ever.
There was the ribbon of blood coming under the door. So Lestrade says, what do you suppose was above the murdered man? I felt a creeping of the flesh and a presentiment of coming horror even before Sherlock Holmes answered. The word rache written in letters of blood, he said.
Dun, dun, dun. Dun.
Rachel once again strikes, right?
That same word that we saw from the previous murder is here again.
And once again, here we have Watson, who actually has that sort of sentimental reaction, right? Or that sensational reaction of he feels his flesh creeping. He has that presentiment. Ooh, what is there is very bad. So this is something that obviously Doyle gets really, really good at by the time we get to Baskerville's, like almost 30 years later. But here, you know, he's starting to work with it. He's starting to build that up.
He's building it for the audience, that we are supposed to be feeling these things. And so he gives us this character of Watson, who is going to be our stand-in and who is feeling these things, to indicate where we should be feeling these things.
Exactly.
And what we should note now, even though it will reveal itself towards the end of this chapter, this is part of it that just doesn't, in my opinion, get resolved. So we're going to have a number of revelations as we work our way to what could have been the end of the story. But this to me is one of those things that still remains out there on ultimately why would you, if you're going to kill somebody, why are you really even writing this down? Why are you taking your knife and cleaning it off, and writing these words on the wall?
We still have seven chapters to go, right?
Right. This is kind of an ending. This is the ending of part one, but we go straight into part two. This is not the end of the mystery, although it appears to be at the end of this chapter.
Yes, exactly.
So, and it's really clearly noted here, like, Sherlock knows who did it, but we don't. And so we still have half of the novel to go. So now here again, Watson realizes that murder is scarier than war. And he says, there was something so methodical and so incomprehensible about the deeds of this unknown assassin that it imparted a fresh ghastliness to his crimes. My nerves, which were steady enough on the field of battle, tingled as I thought of it. And I think that that's important, that all the way through, we are seeing from the eyes of this military doctor that the notion of just like one-on-one crime, that decision to take another life in this way of murder rather than battle is horrifying beyond belief.
Do you think that could be part of Victorian, I don't know, not mores, sort of how they view things? You know, on the battle, you're interesting enough, you're fighting with honor as you go do things. Yep. But at in your home, certainly, it is not a death of honor. It is not a death that premeditated or whatever it eventually comes out to be. But the point is, it's certainly, I think you mentioned it in a previous conversation, where it's where we're supposed to feel safe. This is not supposed to happen here.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right, is that if you're in war, you know you're in war. If you're just walking around, you don't know that you could be murdered.
So, sure.
Yeah. Now, Lestrade shares his clues, and he's got quite a number of them, right? So there's the milk boy, who I thought we might want to call the milk.
Since the boot boy is called Boots, you call the milk boy Milk.
The milk. So I thought that was very funny. So as he was going around delivering milk super early in the morning, he notices that at this hotel, there's a ladder and there's a tall red-faced man in a long brown coat who's walking down the ladder. And so I thought that was weird. Like, where did this guy get the ladder? Are we going to... I mean, you know, like... You know, it's, I don't know. Were you guys struck by that?
Nope.
Like, where is a ladder?
Nope. That completely went past me.
I've read this novel before, but I don't remember if we're ever going to find out. I just paused there.
I'm wondering if it was thrown out as a clue that maybe was not resolved. I haven't read the rest of this.
Well, it's the same. It's the same guy. Like, that's the thing, is that the murderer does look exactly how Holmes said he would look, right?
Sure.
And we still don't know why. Right. And we still don't know why Holmes knew that. So we still have a mystery there.
Exactly. And Watson asked him point blank, and he said, oh, I can't tell you. I don't want to reveal everything, my friend. Lestrade has a whole bunch of clues, right?
Yes, he does.
Yes. Stangerson has a telegram from Cleveland dated from a month ago with the phrase, J.H. is in Europe. That's all the clue that we get from that telegram.
I don't think that has anything to do with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. I'm just going to throw that out there.
There's a novel on the bed, a pipe on a chair, a glass of water on a table, and a small chip ointment box containing a couple of pills on the windowsill. Holmes sprang from his chair with an exclamation of delight. "The last link," he cried exultantly. "My case is complete." And we're like, wait, which one of those is it the novel, the pipe, the water, the telegram, or the pills? Which one?
Bring me the sick dog.
But didn't that feel like the game of Clue there for a moment?
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, like how
Colonel Mustard in the library with the candlestick.
Exactly.
In the novel. Yeah, it's like, okay, we have a whole bunch of things and a really excited Sherlock Holmes, but the audience is totally in the dark here.
Well, Steve, we're just not that bright. You got to realize that some people figured this out long ago, and it'd be Sherlock Holmes. The rest of us will just sit around.
And the chapter is called A Light in the Darkness, right? And there's only one light in this darkness, and that's Holmes. And I mean, that's what Watson's showing us in this whole novel.
Mm-hmm. We are doing a character analysis of this character, and that's what this whole novel is about. It's not about the mystery almost at all. It is not one of those stories that Doyle gives us the information that we need to solve it. It's just about this character. So then there's this moment where we've got these pills, these unknown pills, and they do a little bit of an analysis of what these pills are, and Sherlock Holmes asks for the dog that was maybe mentioned earlier, that was a sick dog that was
Steve, he's an older medical dog. Help. Yeah. Certainly had a full life, yes. And they were going to take it out to the farm so it could run around.
Right.
But they decided that there was another way. If we could solve a mystery, well, Rex will be known forever.
Zoinks!
Scooby, that's right. Bring me Scooby.
I would have gotten away with it, too. So they give these pills to this dog, and the first pill does nothing, has no effect whatsoever. The second pill, almost immediately, this dog dies.
All right, yeah, but let's make sure we're clear on this. Sherlock Holmes is baffled why this is not working, because and as I was reading it, I kept going, well, he must think that he's made a mistake, or this is just another chance of him being humanizing this deity that is Sherlock Holmes. But he's like, it's just not working. It's just not working. What's going on? And at the same time, he's being questioned a little bit. And then all of a sudden, the dog, you know, takes this look that is like those other two dead people.
After the dog dies, Sherlock Holmes drew a long breath and wiped the perspiration from his forehead. "I should have more faith," he said. "I ought to know by this time that when a fact appears to be opposed to a long train of deductions, it invariably proves to be capable of bearing some other interpretation." So he's sort of, this is where we realize, like, he's still learning his trade and building his own confidence, right? Mm-hmm. He was actually thinking, whoa, what if all my deductions were wrong during that first pill? But then he realized, no. There are two different pills. So that's, in fact, the realization that he's making. In later stories, he wouldn't have this hesitation, I don't think.
I will agree with you. Because certainly when we got to the return of Sherlock Holmes, he was very, very confident in what he was doing. And and that confidence shows up with the, you know, would be the Lestrade character, or they have reverence for his skill. But right now, you know, they don't know him very well. And he also is, you know, an inexperienced person, very confident in his skill, but very humble in kind of letting it kind of play out.
And Holmes does not have a mentor. So, like, later on, we're going to see him be a mentor to young Stanley Hopkins, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't have anyone that he can turn to. He has to figure it out for himself.
Hmm. Bruce Wayne doesn't exist at this time.
Exactly.
That's what's keeping him from having a mentor. When we get to Batman Beyond, then we can have Bruce Wayne in the Batcave telling the young boy as Batman what to do. Okay, and now I got it, Chip. Now I understand. Thank you. Thank you for explaining. Holmes engages us in competition when he turns to the three men in the room and says, "All this seems strange to you because you failed at the beginning of the inquiry to grasp the importance of the single real clue which was presented to you, readers."
And this is where that notion of fair play comes in, right? So we have received every clue needed to solve this mystery, but we have no idea what's going on. And the three men in the room beg Holmes to tell them, almost like as if they're talking on behalf of the reader. So Gregson goes first. "Come on, I admit that I made a mistake. You got to tell me." Lestrade's like, "We've been doing everything, you know, come on." And then Watson comes in with a totally different tactic. He says any delay in arresting the assassin might give him time to perpetrate some fresh atrocity. So he's just trying to save lives. He's not curious, just trying to save lives. "Thus, pressed by us all, Holmes showed signs of irresolution. He continued to walk up and down the room with his head sunk on his chest and his brows drawn down, as was his habit when lost in thought. 'There will be no more murders,' he said at last, stopping abruptly and facing us. And he tells them he does know the name of the murderer, but he has to handle this delicately." And I really like how he says, "Without meaning to hurt either of your feelings, I am bound to say that I consider these men to be more than a match for the official force. And that is why I have not asked your assistance."
What a backhanded compliment.
What a nice guy to not want to hurt their feelings by telling them how incompetent they are.
Right? And if I'm Caesar Lestrade, my response to that, then we'll just consider you an accomplice to this murder.
Right?
I mean, at some point, who's got the power here? Well, Holmes is so bright, but Lestrade can get, "Hey, listen, if you know who did this, then you could be an accomplice as far as I'm concerned."
But he doesn't do that, does he? Because
No, he does not.
He wants to solve the case and he wants the credit, right?
And he wants to do it with the biggest flourish that he can, because this is a really big Holmes flourish here.
Right.
That's why he has peacock feathers with him at all times. Just go ahead and strut around.
Did you guys like this scene? I love this final scene.
You mean when Wiggins arrives, that little kid?
It's so Holmes. This is so indicative of what we've seen from Holmes. He could have just said the guy's name, sent out an APB, had somebody out there in the world arrest the guy. No. He has to not only come into the rooms. Holmes says, "Oh, come here and help me with my suitcase." Which Watson goes, "Wait a minute. Why does he have a suitcase? Is he going somewhere? Why is there a cab here?" The cab driver is the guy. And Sherlock Holmes springs from his place and slaps cuffs on him. Even worse than that,
Steve, before the cab driver even walks in, Holmes holds up a pair of handcuffs, right, to Lestrade and Gregson. And he's like, "Don't you guys think these are beautiful handcuffs? You guys should use this kind at Scotland Yard. They look at how beautifully the spring works," he says. "They fasten super fast." And Lestrade and Gregson are like, "You just insulted us. You know who the murderer is. We don't. Why are you showing us your handcuffs?" "Well, because the murderer is about to walk in the room." It's so great.
What gives a citizen the right to put handcuffs on another person after accusing them of murder?
Come on, it's Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, come on now.
And I love that. Yeah, so the cabbie comes up to help with the bags. Click. "Gentlemen," Holmes cried with flashing eyes, "let me introduce you to Mr. Jefferson Hope, the murderer of Enoch Drebber and of Joseph Stangerson." Ta-da! think it's the best.
Hold for applause.
Yeah. Right?
And now right? I am going to take this large statue and make it disappear.
For my next trick. Yes, this is definitely Holmes the Conjurer, the big reveal, the dramatic actor who is showing us instead of telling us.
And Hope does not take well to having handcuffs put on him, does he?
He doesn't have a lot of hope. I'm sorry. He has a little bit of hope as he dives out the window.
Right? And it takes all four of them. And this is where Watson does actually get involved. He doesn't just watch as the three detectives take down this one, this guy who seems to be almost in like a paroxysm. Watson also helps. And finally, they bind his feet as well as his hands because he's so out of control. And then we reach the ending. And now, gentlemen, Holmes continued with a pleasant smile, we have reached the end of our little mystery. You are very welcome to put any questions that you like to me now, and there is no danger that I will refuse to answer them. End chapter. End of. So, know everything that Holmes knows. Are you guys ready to solve this?
There you go. Solved. Problem solved. There you go. There's another evil lurking behind this guy, and Holmes knows who it is, and we don't have any clue who it is at this point.
What do you think is going to happen for the next seven chapters, my friends?
Well, we're obviously going to solve another part of this mystery, because Holmes at some point says there are two involved here, or at least two. And we've got one of those two.
Well, so because we have Mr. Jefferson Hope, who is not the same guy who came to Holmes' office dressed as an elderly crone and who was like super active and getting out of the cab.
Mm-hmm. This is the red-faced man who we've been looking for, but this is not the same guy that was there before. So we still have a suspect on the loose here.
Right.
So this is the intermission. This is where we go and you can get some popcorn or some candy or a hot dog or something like that. And
some tea and scones, perhaps.
Sure. It is a fancy theater. It's a fancy theater. But it certainly is. This was very satisfying. I enjoyed this part.
Really? You're satisfied by this ending?
Listen, it's set up. Exactly. The curtain's gone down, Steve. We got to come back. We got more.
Yeah, it is certainly theatrical. It is certainly an act one ending that leaves so many questions unanswered. I'll give you that. But I was not satisfied by this act one ending. I'm not sure that I would come back after intermission. I'm not satisfied right now. I'm not okay with, and ta-da, this is the guy. I'm like, but how do you know?
That's why you come back, to find out how he knows.
Steve, you can bring your beer. You can bring your beer in here and have some popcorn as we start at part two.
All right.
And guys, don't forget, we still have to find out if any of those newspapers had it right. You know, is this a political crime? Is this because the liberals are in power? Is this because there are foreigners in London, right? Where does this mystery come from? Is it because he's American from Cleveland? Like, there are a lot of questions. And I really like that here at the end of part one, just like the previous chapter, we're completely in Baker Street. Watson and Holmes are sitting in their home and everyone comes to them to do the action right in front of them in their own space.
And there's your first theatricality. Lesson. There's your first lesson. If you're going to murder something, don't show up at Sherlock Holmes' house.
Right.
It's a setup. It's a total setup.
Valid. I'll take that. That is true. Okay, fine. I'm intrigued. Let's get to part two tomorrow. We'll get to chapter eight and try to see what's going to happen. What's Sherlock going to do in chapter eight?
And no animals were harmed in the writing of this story.
Probably not.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Poor doggy.
He had a full life.
That's right. He'll be running in that on that farm up north for a long time. Boys and girls, don't worry about it.
That's right.
Hopefully you're having fun enjoying this story as much as we are and looking forward to Act 2 that we will start tomorrow. Give us a call. Give us a text. We'd love to hear from you. What are you thinking? How are you thinking? Is this satisfying to you more than it was to me? Because, but okay. You can send us a text or a voicemail. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes. Go to our website, sandwichesatirregularhours.com, to see all of these fun conversations. Some of them are more satisfying than others. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Passenflo.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
Where's my sandwich? What I want to talk about.